As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Episode number 11. Today we're looking at the Intolerable Acts passed by the Parliament in 1774 in response to the British Tea Party. They are a series of five acts that were designed to punish the Massachusetts colonists who dumped tea into Boston Harbor to protest the Tea Act. In Britain, they were known as the Coercive Acts, and in the American colonies as the Insufferable Acts, or more widely known today as the Intolerable Acts. They were a key development leading to the outbreak of the Revolutionary War in April 1775. Four of the acts directly addressed the Massachusetts colonists' actions, and the fifth limited the colonies' expansion.
The first of these acts was the Boston Port Act, which was passed in 1774 in response to the Boston Tea Party. It closed the port of Boston until the colonists paid for the destroyed tea and the king was satisfied that order had been restored in the colonies.
The second act, known as the Massachusetts Government Act, provided even more outrage than the Port Act because it unilaterally took away Massachusetts' charter and brought it under control of the British government. Under the terms of the Government Act, almost all positions in the colonial government were to be appointed by the governor, parliament, or the king. The act also severely limited town meetings in Massachusetts to one per year unless the governor called for one.
The third act was the Administration of Justice Act, which allowed the royal governor to order trials of accused royal officials to take place in Great Britain or elsewhere within the empire if he decided that the defendant could not get a fair trial in Massachusetts. I mean, essentially, it's that idea of taking away the right of a trial in the place where the crime was committed.
And then we have the fourth act, the Quartering Act. That may sound familiar, but this one's a little different. The Quartering Act, which applied to all British colonies in North America, sought to create a more effective method of housing British troops. In the previous Quartering Act that we discussed in Week 2, the colonies had been required to provide housing for soldiers, but colonial legislatures have been uncooperative in doing so. The new Quartering Act allowed a governor to house soldiers in other buildings if suitable quarters were not provided.
And then the fifth act, which was really passed a little bit later, but is often lumped into these intolerable acts, was called the Quebec Act. It was passed in the same parliamentary session and was considered by colonists to be one of the intolerable acts, although it was not directly related to the retaliation against the Boston Tea Party. The act expanded the territory of the province of Quebec into the Great Lakes region and much of what is now the Midwestern United States, which to the colonists appeared to void the land claims of the Ohio Company in the region. The guarantee of free practice of Catholicism, the major religion in Canada, was seen by the colonists as an establishment of the faith of the colonists, which were overwhelmingly Protestant. Furthermore, colonists resented the lenient provisions granted to their enemies who they had fought hard against in the French and Indian War. So the Quebec Act basically cut off expansion of the colonies westward to took land they considered theirs, gave it to the colony of Quebec, and allowed Catholicism to be an established religion. So not a direct response to the Boston Tea Party, but an act that the colonists considered intolerable because it took away their basic rights.
So as we look at the impact of these five, many colonists saw the intolerable acts as a violation of their rights, their natural rights, and their colonial charters. They therefore viewed the acts as a threat to all the liberties of all of British America, not just Massachusetts. Legislation denounced the act was swift, and Richard Henry Lee, made famous in the 1976 musical 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia described the acts as, quote, a most wicked system for destroying the liberty of America, unquote. The citizens of Boston viewed the intolerable acts as unnecessary and cruel punishment, further inflaming hatred toward Britain.
The United Kingdom, Great Britain, had hoped that the intolerable acts would isolate the radicals in Massachusetts and cause the American colonies to concede the authority of Parliament over their elected assemblies. This was a calculated risk by Parliament that backfired. The harshness of some of the acts made it difficult for colonial moderates to speak in favor of Parliament. Instead, the acts only served to distance the colony from the crown, created sympathy for Massachusetts among the other colonies, and encouraged colonists from the otherwise diverse colonies to form committees of correspondence, which sent delegates to the First Continental Congress. The Continental Congress created the Continental Association, an agreement to boycott British goods. Additionally, it was decided that if the intolerable acts were not reversed after a year, goods were to stop being exported to Great Britain as well, kind of modern tariff wars almost. The Congress also pledged to support Massachusetts in case of attack, which meant that all of the colonies would become involved when the American Revolutionary War began at Lexington and Concord, which we'll discuss next week.
So again, Bruce, we've often asked this question. There are numerous events over the next 250 years of American history that echo these efforts to control, and we see those nationally and locally. What are some of the most significant of these historic events?
Well, of course, one of the most significant over time are what has often been termed the Indian Wars and the resulting treaties that come out of those wars. And these are a series of conflicts that go on for, you know, almost 100 years, well over 100 years. They're still going on to some extent today, not in terms of armed conflict as often as in terms of legal conflict. But the idea of sort of controlling Indian tribes, fighting wars against Indian tribes, and then signing treaties with them to control those tribes was just really an extension of that concept of what Parliament was trying to do to the colonies. I mean, each Indian war, each Indian nation was essentially viewed as an independent nation. So these treaties were essentially like modern treaties between the United States and France or the United States and Germany. They were viewed as treaties between sovereign nations. And that's what comes into conflict, particularly in the 1960s and 70s as the Indian power movement takes place and Indian nations begin to try and reassert their rights. And they have access to these treaties and to court cases that ultimately end up in the Bolt decision in the 1970s that sort of recognize the validity of these treaties and the validity of the wording of these treaties that give Indian nations sovereign rights. So you have this whole sort of sense of these Indian wars going on. And for us today, we look back at these treaties and we see them as sort of basically colonial impositions on sovereign Indian nations. At the time, the Americans viewed them as very liberal, very socially conscious at the time. I mean, they essentially provided for education, for schools, for doctors, for training, for money to be paid to tribes. And yet, at base behind them, philosophically, they were essentially designed to erase Native culture and to turn American Indians into American white citizens, you know, and sort of eliminate their culture. And so as we look back today, we can see how those treaties and how those Indian wars really become a way of sort of depopulating the American West and turning over vast tracts of land to the federal government, then to be sold off or given to railroads and to other entrepreneurial interests, and basically sort of make the American nation, you know, sort of a continuous property, if you will, from sea to shining sea. And so there's a very interesting way to look back at how what happened with the Intolerable Acts are really an extension of what plays out with our Indian treaties, beginning with the Sullivan Expedition, which we'll talk about later in this series, where George Washington sends Colonel Sullivan into the sort of trans-Appalachian West in New York to basically eliminate the Iroquois Nation. And then the Trail of Tears, Wounded Knee. I mean, the list is long of sort of attacks on Indian nations, but it's essentially an extension of what the British were trying to do with the Intolerable Acts, to eliminate colonial resistance, you know, to punish the colonies for the Boston Tea Party. And, of course, it backfired. It ended up in a revolution.
So all of this carries us forward into the development of amendments to the later Constitution that's still not quite there, but the Bill of Rights, the Second Bill of Rights, and then we get into the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery, the 14th Amendment about citizenship, due process, equal protection under the law. The 15th Amendment is the right to vote and the citizen's right to vote, and some of which overturns previous legal decisions like Dred Scott. And then we have the 18th Amendment, which was prohibition, and then the 19th Amendment for women's suffrage. All of those, for the most part, came after the Civil War, so it's relatively modern history. And we'll be talking about all of them more, but it's interesting to see how the Intolerables continued to drive a lot of activity in the country.
Yeah, I think when you particularly look at the 18th Amendment, the prohibition amendment that outlaws the sale of alcohol in the United States, I mean, most citizens in the United States viewed that as intolerable, you know, and it was incredibly difficult to enforce, you know, and all the sort of Roaring Twenties and Elliot Ness and all of that kind of stuff and the rise of organized crime and Al Capone that sort of came off of that really is a sense of how people, the American people, felt that an action like that, even though there was a lot of support, there was a lot of opposition, and the fact that it couldn't be enforced. And it takes you right back to the Intolerable Acts, where the British imposed all these sort of punishments on Massachusetts and then couldn't follow through. And the colonists sort of rose up and revolted against them, and ultimately, you know, in armed conflict in the Revolutionary War. And the similar kind of thing happens with Prohibition Amendment, you know, that after 6-7 years in enforcement or lack of enforcement, you know, people rise up and the 21st Amendment repeals the 18th Amendment, and we go back to states, generally states controlling the sale of alcohol.
Well, and we may get into this at some point in the future, there was a lot of bootlegging activity in this part of the world because there were lots of boats and we had lots of islands and lots of places to hide. And some of those stories are quite entertaining. And I think generally the bootleggers had faster boats than the government.
Oh, yeah. Well, a couple quick Vashon stories about that. You know, Vashon, when you look at where Vashon's located, it was the perfect sort of halfway point, if you will, between Tacoma and Olympia on the south and British Columbia, where alcohol was not illegal, to the north. And so Vashon, one, had a number of stills producing illegal alcohol, but also was a place where lots of rum runners or bootleggers would bring, store their goods on Vashon, and then in the middle of the night come in, pick them up, and take it to Tacoma. You know, so yeah, Vashon was very much a part of that. The other story that I find is interesting, and I can't get this totally verified other than through reminiscences, was Martin Olick was a shipbuilder in Tacoma, and he went out of business in about 1930, retired, and they closed the shipyard in Docton, and his sons then reopened it in Tacoma. But Martin Olick built the last last fishing boat on Vashon, the Janet G., which is owned by the Green family. That's officially the last boat he built. Unofficially, and I've heard this from a number of different sources, he built one last boat, but it was off the record. He didn't keep the receipts or anything like that. And he built this about 35 to 40 foot speedboat with a Liberty aircraft engine in it. So a 12-cylinder Liberty aircraft engine in it. It was just fast as could be. And it was a rum runner. It was basically a flat-topped runabout with a little periscope kind of a place for the driver to sit to look out, and it could beat any of the revenuers' boats. So Vashon has a connection to Prohibition.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's great. So as we always say, we live in interesting times now. In your view, Bruce, what are some of the most significant events in the U.S. during the past 5 or 6 years that involve control and retaliation?
Well, here at the beginning of 2026, probably the most sort of evident of those kind of things is what's going on in Minneapolis, Minnesota, particularly in January and February of 2026, where ICE raids Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, sort of invaded. This is from the perspective of Minnesotans,
sure.
You know, they often see themselves invaded in much of the way that the colonies saw themselves invaded by British troops. You know, ICE enforcement agents coming in, wearing masks, carrying guns, you know, being using unmarked vehicles, not having name tags, all the kinds of things that American citizens have come to expect of their police enforcement are sort of ignored by ICE agents. And in effect, you know, many in Minnesota see it as an invasion and an imposition of an intolerable, going back to the intolerable acts, of an intolerable enforcement effort to round up immigrants, illegal immigrants, but many of whom are neighbors and friends. And so, just like in the American Revolution, people in Minneapolis organize. They organize patrols in neighborhoods. They walk around with whistles. They walk around with their cell cameras taking videos of things going on. And just like with the Boston Massacre, what you get is the killing of American citizens by ICE agents. You know, two citizens in Minnesota shot, you know, apparently without provocation in Minnesota. And of course, that's always going to be contested. And then evidence of one in Texas a month earlier. And so, yeah, when you look at the intolerable acts and the colony's response to it, you know, very much what's going on in Minneapolis in the first 2 months of 2026 are a good sort of example of how that still goes on. And how the American public sort of responds to actions that they consider intolerable.
And then we look at, while all that goes on, the distractions from the Epstein files, and it really is becoming a distraction. I'm not exactly sure what's coming of it other than a whole long list of people whose lives have been ruined. Maybe good, maybe not. Hard to tell. And you wonder how much of that is premeditated. Was Epstein really connected with that many people, or is it a way just to distract from all this other stuff going on?
And I think that's one of the key questions that will spin itself out here, over the next 6-12 months, until the elections this November, and continue to spin out after that. But essentially, what we're seeing, at least here when we're recording this in late February of 2026, what we're seeing is, American congressmen and congresswomen going in and reading these files and coming out horrified with the details, because they're seeing the unredacted files. And what we're seeing from international responses, where particularly in Europe, where individual politicians in places like England and Norway and Denmark and Germany are being exposed in these files because they have the unredacted files.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a major sort of reaction, I think, from the American public as this stuff begins to come out. And as it begins to come out, I think what you're seeing is an attempt by the current administration and by officials within the current administration is to obfuscate, if I can say that word right, as much as possible and delay as long as possible, because, apparently, the allegations and the sort of actions are just horrific.
And then we take it one more step with the recent Supreme Court ruling, and again, we're in the end of February here. The court has just ruled about tariffs. What happens with that? Because there's probably a lot of business people that want some money back, and that could get tangled up in the weeds for years.
Oh yeah, I think so. And what's going to be interesting is to see. I mean, we're right in the middle of it right now, so it's hard to see how it's going to play out. But certainly, the Supreme Court standing up very firmly for sort of what are the rights of Congress and what are the rights of the executive branch. I mean, this is the first time we've seen a ruling by this Supreme Court that has clearly drawn a line to limit executive power. And of course, one of the things that has allowed the current administration to be as activist as it has is that the lines are not well defined.
Right.
And the court is beginning to define those lines. And of course, the administration has reacted with a whole new set of tariffs, but it's going to be interesting to see whether those hold up, how they're enforced, and then how the past tariffs that have been declared unconstitutional are sort of restituted to those who have paid them. It is a mess.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you're trying to obscure what's in the Epstein files, chaos is your friend.
Well, and as we all start doing our taxes for 2025, if you believe what you hear and read, the big, beautiful bill is going to give us lots of money back in our tax returns. We'll see what happens with that. I'm not seeing it in my current return, I'll tell you that.
In fact, I jumped on it early. I did my taxes. I just got my return back yesterday.
And are you filthy rich?
Well, you gotta have that to start with. So no, but it was a surprising sort of return based on what I've had in the past. And so yeah, the big beautiful bill has cut taxes substantially, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. With this sort of the American economy, in the terms of the Trump administration, is based on tariffs bringing in income to replace the income that's been given back in tax relief. Well, if the tariffs are illegal, then what's going to make up that difference between tax relief that's going back to taxpayers, tariffs that are not coming in, and the deficit is already growing at a tremendous rate.
So much for your 2026 tax return.
Yep.
So in our remaining time, let's take a look at Vashon specific, and what are some of the events here on the island that echo these national and recent violent events? Again, we don't usually have violent, but we certainly have some events on the island.
Well, and as we've talked before, I mean, certainly the ferry strikes of the 1930s and 1940s, and islanders' responses to them have been significant. I mean, in the 1939 ferry strike, Vashon Islanders actually boarded the ferry and held it hostage, in effect, over at Harper for a day, basically to ensure that the ferry would come back to Vashon. And, of course, in the 1947 Vashon vigilante incident, Vashon Islanders actually armed themselves and went down to the ferry dock to prevent the Black Ball ferries from landing on Vashon. So, yeah, when it comes to ferries, people get pretty upset.
That's pretty much our big one.
But there's also others. I mean, there's been a number of attempts by the island to break away from King County, either to form a separate county or to join with Pierce County, particularly the south end of Vashon Island, to join with Pierce County. And so there's been a number of efforts all through, beginning in the late 1890s, and particularly in about 1913, when the state legislature actually created a Vashon County, but it didn't pass the Senate, and so it died. But then in the 20s and the 30s, attempts by the south end to join with Pierce County, attempts to break away in the 50s and 60s and create our own county, and then in the 1990s to incorporate, to become a city and sort of free ourselves from King County in that way. So none of them have resulted in people on the street armed with rifles shooting at each other. But basically, it's come as close as Vashon has been to kind of that revolutionary fervor. And then, of course, today on Vashon, the development kind of issues. It's very important for King County that Vashon remain rural so that King County can meet its provisions under the State Growth Management Act, which sort of forces them to anchor development into existing urban areas. And if you're familiar with the mainland, I mean, the areas to the south of Seattle, Kent, Auburn, places like that, to the east, Fall City and Duval and places like that, have just become an urban expanse. Whereas Vashon, while those places have become urbanized, has remained very rural and very what I would call exurban. Mm-hmm. So lots of ways in which the Intolerable Acts sort of echo in Vashon.
And with that, let's wrap it up. And you'll want to be with us next time when we talk about Paul Revere and Two Arms, the Redcoats are coming. Thanks for joining us. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. That's vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.